In the first hour of the program today, we will be talking with historian Douglas Brinkley about his recently published biography of Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry. The title of the book is Tour of Duty, and it concentrates primarily on Kerry's experiences in Vietnam, although it is more than that. It does indeed look at his childhood and his family, and then at the fact that after Vietnam, he joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and became a leading anti-war activist. Brinkley says of Kerry and his experiences, the entire heart and soul of Kerry's persona is in Vietnam. What happened to him is seared into his being. The book, Tour of Duty, John Kerry and the Vietnam War, is published by William Morrow and Company. It's out in bookstores now if you'd like to read it. Our guest, Douglas Brinkley, is director of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies and professor of history at University of New Orleans. And his recent publications include Wheels for the World, Henry Ford, His Company, and A Century of Progress, and also the book The Mississippi and the Making of a Nation with Stephen Ambrose. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they are brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible and keep the program moving. Anyone who's interested in joining the conversation, though, can do that. The telephone number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Now, we do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or if you would happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Brinkley, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Thank you for talking with us. Just to talk a little bit about how it is this project happened to be in the first place, I guess it's my understanding that you originally thought you would like to do a book about senators who served in Vietnam, but by the time that the project really got going, most of them had already written their own stories, and the only one who hadn't was John Kerry. At that time, when this project started, was there even the notion on the horizon that he would be running for president?
Well, he had been rumored to be considering running, as, of course, there were a lot of other leading Democrats. It didn't interest me so much. Certainly, I cared about the fact that John Kerry was a U.S. senator and a fairly well-known U.S. senator as my lead character in a Vietnam drama. But what attracted me to Kerry, as you mentioned, was the fact that nobody had yet written anything on him. But also, I wanted to do a book about the Navy as I started thinking about it. And he was on these swift boats, 50-foot aluminum boats, that penetrated the deepest, darkest regions of the Cao Mau Peninsula and Mekong Delta in Vietnam. And so you had all these combat action sequences about the brown water Navy and riverine warfare. But you also had with Kerry the anti-war movement. And you know, Vietnam, in my mind, isn't just battlefield, exploits. It's really about the politics of Vietnam and about the home front and all of it's combined. And suddenly I saw in Kerry a perfect story of telling one young man's odyssey through Vietnam, and I thought it might shed new light on a lot of different subjects. Kerry made the history books in 1971, when he went in front of the Fulbright Committee, meaning if you pick out whether it's Stanley Carnell's Wonderful History of Vietnam or a book by George Herring, a great University of Kentucky professor, you'll find the name Kerry in the index of histories of Vietnam as a young man in his 20s. So he already was a historical figure. And then the capstone of it all was that Kerry kept voluminous war diaries throughout this period, reflecting on Vietnam, and so the combo of all that made him the perfect character for me to write about.
Yeah, and before you began this project and sat down for your first interview with Mr. Kerry, you and he had actually never met. Is that right?
I never met him. I ran the Eisenhower Center, and we had done a large World War II oral history project. We interviewed thousands of veterans from D-Day, Battle of the Bulge, Iwo Jima, on and on. We have now, a few years ago, started a Vietnam War oral history project. So in my mind at that time, Kerry was just one of 100 people I was interviewing at the time. It is true he was harder to get to as being a busy senator than a lot of the veterans. I was going to veterans reunions, men from the Battle of Quezon and taping them and getting their recollections. The great tip I had is that his chief of staff told me, Kerry's Senate chief of staff had told me that he kept all these war diaries, but he never lets anybody see them. And at the end of my interview with Senator Kerry, I started lobbying to take a look at those, and I eventually succeeded.
Hmm. It's interesting you mentioned the fact that after his service, he became involved in the anti-war movement, and he got some national prominence, testified before Congress, and made this now famous comment, "How do you ask a man to be the last to die for a mistake?" And it got so much attention, he came to be interviewed on 60 Minutes by Morley Safer. And apparently, Morley Safer asked the then 27-year-old John Kerry, "Do you want to be president?" And Kerry seemed sort of stunned that he had asked the very question. And he said, no, he said, this is not the time to be thinking about that or talking about that. And this was before he began his career in electoral politics. But I guess you do have to wonder at what point someone starts thinking about that, not just the fact that he might be in the Congress, but, you know, at what point does someone start thinking about the fact that he just might be president of the United States?
Well, that is interesting. Very fact that Morley Safer was profiling him at 27 and that Safer would ask him such a question tells you that, you know, a lot about John Kerry. I mean, he was a ambitious young man. I mean, he was the head of Yale Political Union. He gave the class oration at Yale in 1966. He was hosting all these politicians that would come turnstile fashion to Yale. He was always the meet and greet guy on campus. You know, you heard people like Allard Lowenstein speak and Eugene McCarthy, Bobby Kennedy. He started campaigning for Ted Kennedy while in college in 1962. So it's somebody who was, from a very early age, interested in Democratic politics. When he, in his mind, did he ever think he could be president? I asked him that, and, you know, he told me he was always interested in public service, and he thought about running for Congress at an early age and Senate, but he never thought about the White House. But I'm sure there were moments when it flashed across his mind.
Mm. He certainly now is the clear front runner in the race for the nomination, Democratic nomination, to run for president. Perhaps at the end of the day, we would have an even better idea of how this is likely to work out. But clearly, he is well ahead of the man who is number two, John Edwards. How much do you think of his appeal to Democrats has to do with his service in Vietnam?
I think a great deal of it. Only at this particular moment in time. I think after 9/11, the soccer moms, as they used to say in the 1990s, have become security moms. For a Democrat to compete with George W. Bush, who's been commander-in-chief at a time of our country's being attacked and then had to lead us in a war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I think the Democrats had to have a candidate with foreign affairs credentials and somebody that knew something about military affairs. And I think it's the reason why Wesley Clark entered the fray. There was a feeling because he was a general he would make a good candidate. And I think it's what differentiated John Kerry from, say, a John Edwards. It isn't their views on domestic programs that Eric Kerry seems much more enlightened than Edwards, say, or Gephardt or Lieberman. I think it's the fact that Kerry had served and has those medals on his chest. And when he says, "I know something about aircraft carriers for real, bring it on," and would get thunderous applause from people in Iowa and New Hampshire, where there was a feeling that it was going to be harder for Bush and Vice President Cheney to attack a guy like John Kerry because neither Bush or Cheney served in Vietnam. In fact, 5 deferments Dick Cheney finagled to avoid service, and President Bush served admirably in the Texas Air Guard. But it's the great trump card Kerry has going for him right now is his military service.
We have a couple of callers here ready to go, so I guess I will get to them. We'll not make them wait, and of course, we'll continue to talk with our guest, Douglas Brinkley, author of a recently published biography of John Kerry that concentrates primarily, although not exclusively, on his experiences in Vietnam. The title of the book is Tour of Duty. We have a couple of callers here ready to go. The first up is in Belgium, nearby community, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. In the same vein you're talking about there in Vietnam and Mr. Kerry, recent reports say that this administration is attacking Kerry for his anti-war stance after Vietnam. I don't understand how that could possibly be construed as a negative in these days, 30 years after the end of this horrid war.
Well, that's an interesting point. John Kerry certainly doesn't think it's a negative. Kerry is the man I interviewed, and this was, you know, now quite a while ago. I taped him for 12 hours, is exceedingly proud about his anti-war service. In fact, he wrote a book back in 1971 protesting the Vietnam War called The New Soldier, and I saw the Weekly Standard, a conservative rag, recently wrote a ridiculous article claiming that Kerry doesn't want anybody to see this book and that it's he's trying to hide it from the public. In truth, Kerry's working furiously to get the book back in print in time for September so it's out in bookstores. So there's a disconnect here. Kerry's proud of his anti-war protest and his service, where Republicans think he should not be proud of it. And I think it's going to play out in the election. We'll see whether Vietnam still has any life in it. I think the reason Vietnam's become so prevalent in this campaign is Kerry's famous anti-war line, the most famous line of his career, is how do you ask a man to be a last man to die for a mistake? And that was about Vietnam, but people can see that line in Iraq today. I mean, how do you ask a man to be a last man to die for a mistake? If, I'm not saying it was, but if our war, our preemptive war in Iraq was mistaken, then how do we ask soldiers there, 500 plus, to give up their lives since President Bush declared mission accomplished on the USS Lincoln? And I think the drama of Vietnam is going to play out this election year due to the war in Iraq.
Maybe this is much more telling about the administration than the candidate running against him. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller here. This is line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I was interested to hear that Kerry volunteered for the Navy, that he wasn't drafted. So I wondered, why did he volunteer? Why did he turn against the war?
His father, first off, John Kerry was born in Denver, Colorado in 1943. It's significant because the reason he was born in Denver is that his father, during World War II, was a Army Air Corps test pilot and would fly planes at the highest altitude imaginable, like the Wright Stuff pilots of Tom Wolfe lore. And he contracted tuberculosis, an airborne infectious disease, from flying so high. And he ended up really barely staying alive, struggling for his life against the fight against TB, and was hospitalized in Denver at a Fitzsimmons General Hospital, which had a TB ward there to treat people. Kerry was born with a father gravely ill, and his father then was eventually forced out of the U.S. military, but continued to get his paychecks from the government. He joined the Foreign Service and had a very distinguished career as a diplomat. So the young John Kerry bounced around. He saw the, you know, Normandy, the cemetery there with the D-Day graves. He was lived in Berlin and went to school in Switzerland and spent a lot of time in Oslo. And the reason I tell you all this to answer your question is that Richard Kerry, John's father, had a great sense of public service, of duty. It's old-fashioned and antiquated today. But back then, in the 1950s, when John was growing up, Richard Kerry believed that his son would serve the country, that you went into the military as part of your payback to the government. And so if you cut to 1965, when Kerry volunteers for the U.S. Navy at Yale, his father thought that was the right thing to do. Yet his father was also very much opposed to American intervention in Southeast Asia. In other words, he wanted his son to enlist in the military. He hoped that the Vietnam War would be over soon, that it was a mistake. But so Kerry went in not to go fight in Vietnam, but to do his obligation. And I asked him, and he felt that, you know, he couldn't understand how he would have lived with himself if, because he had some privilege, if he had finagled a deferment or went to Canada or, you know, got himself into a National Guard billet, leaping ahead of people, how he could have lived with himself if he had done that, knowing others. He wanted other Americans to do his bidding for him, his service for him, his fighting for him. And so Kerry joined, and he went on. And, you know, at Yale University, I might add, there was a long tradition of that. In World War I and World War II, Yale students couldn't wait to get into the armed forces as a way of showing their service to country. And I think Kerry was touched also with a bit of that old-fashioned Yale ethos. By 1968, that old-fashioned ethos had died. Anti-war sentiment, fervor was all over New Haven, and Kerry may have thought, decided differently a few years later. But in 65, it was just on the heels of Johnson sending all the troops to Vietnam. It was unclear if we were going to be stuck there for so long.
And with caller, does that get at your question?
Yes, and the service that he did was extremely hazardous. Was he assigned that? He didn't try to get out of that.
No, he didn't. In his first service, first tour, I've been very frustrated with the media that keeps saying John Kerry was only in Vietnam for 4 months. It was actually 5. But then they forget that he had a previous tour of duty. That was only on Swift boats he was there for and got wounded 3 times and 3 Purple Hearts. He did a whole tour of duty on the USS Gridley from January of 68 to June of 68. He was in the Gulf of Tonkin providing support cover and also was in Da Nang, for example. And it was there in Da Nang that he saw his first Swift boat, these 50-foot aluminum boats, and Kerry wanted to command one because, you know, as a lieutenant in charge of your own boat, you're the boss. You got 5 guys under you. It was something a lot of young, particularly, you know, an Ivy League educated young officer would love to have his own command. He wouldn't have to listen to captains barking orders to you on the Gridley. And he also wanted to go to Swift school because it meant you got out of Vietnam. You got to go home to see your girlfriend for 2 months. Then you went through a 6-week training program in Coronado, California, San Diego. So Kerry thought that's a pretty good deal. Go home, see his girlfriend, go to school for Swift boat training, and maybe the Vietnam War would be over. After all, it was 1968, and Lyndon Johnson resigned after the Tet Offensive, or said he wouldn't seek re-election. Nixon said he had a plan of getting us out of Vietnam. Humphrey wanted us out. So Kerry figured he'd just buy some time in Swift boat school, get over there, do some coastal duty on the Swift boats. The war would be over. They'd be sent home. And he'd get on with his life. Instead, he arrived in Vietnam in October 1968 for the second tour of duty. And he was ordered into the river systems. These 50-foot boats were no longer searching commercial vessels along South Vietnam's coast. They were being inserted in the rivers like the Bay Hap River or Bo Di River, and being sent on essentially suicide missions. 75% of all Swift boats that went up these rivers got terribly mangled, shot at, deaths, arms missing, limbs missing of some sort or another. It was the most dangerous duty anybody in the U.S. Navy saw, not just in Vietnam, but perhaps in any recent American war.
Well, I want to thank the caller for the questions. Other people who are listening certainly can call in if you have questions, comments. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking about the fact that by virtue of his upbringing, who his father was, his class position in a sense, there was the notion that he was obligated, that he had a duty to do this service to the country. I wonder, as you talked with him, though, or whether you talked with him about that, was there this sense that this was something he accepted reluctantly as a burden, or was it something that he embraced in a positive kind of way?
Well, I think, you know, by early 68, in letters home, one that I read to his mother and father, I mean, he's already explaining, Mom and Dad, I really am an uncommitted soldier. I think this, you know, war is a terrible mistake, but my job is to, you know, do my duty and get out. He also, of course, when he became a commanding officer, was suddenly responsible for men's lives. And anybody who knows anything about military affairs, I mean, that becomes a very heavy responsibility. He, in his diaries I read, is just lambasting Nixon and Melvin Laird and Kissinger and the absurdity of American intervention in Vietnam, the fact that he started feeling what they were doing there was immoral, that they weren't winning over the Vietnamese people, that they were actually intruders. He's gushing all that out in his diaries. On the other hand, he can't sit and moan and complain when he has men's morale. He has to, you know, he's got to bring these guys back home alive. They're going on these dangerous missions, and he has to keep a cool head and make decisions as an officer that saves their lives. And I'm just constantly amazed why people are so, you know, sometimes surprised or the Republicans seem to be trying to pick away at Kerry in Vietnam, when every single guy that served with John Kerry in Vietnam that were actually served with him on his boats, they're all for him for president, and they're all campaigning for him. And, you know, and people say, why are they for him, even though they're Republicans or conservatives? It's because John Kerry brought him home alive. And that's a very big thing, you know. That's a gigantic, that transcends political bickering or different disagreements on energy policy or something. Kerry was a very, very smart officer. And some people have been saying Kerry took risk in Vietnam on the rivers, on winning a Silver Star by beaching the boat and killing the enemy. If he had not beached a boat and right over a spider hole where a guy was facing the rocket, it was an unusual maneuver, but far from being a risky one, it saved his boat. I saw nothing of risk-taking of John Kerry. I saw him making snap decisions there that saved his crew, which was, you know, his number one job, as he saw it, was to keep his crew alive.
We have several callers here ready to go, and before we do that, there's just one thing we need to do. We need to take a short break here because this is the first Wednesday of the month, and at 10:30 we always run this test. So we'll do that, and then we'll resume our conversation here with Douglas Brinkley. This is a test of the emergency alert system.
This message was instituted by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. This station is participating in a required monthly test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
This is AM 580 WILL Urbana. The program is Focus 580. My name is David Inge. And again, this morning our guest is Douglas Brinkley. He's director of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies and professor of history at the University of New Orleans and is author of the book Tour of Duty, John Kerry and the Vietnam War. It is published by William Morrow and Company. Well, we have some other callers here to talk with, and they are all in Urbana, so we'll take them in the order they came in and start with line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I am a Democrat, and I was really pleased because I'd wondered why, you know, Kerry so gleefully went off to war in 68. So I really appreciated knowing a fuller story as you were relating it from his diaries. I have a couple questions, and I came in quite late to the program. And my first, I'll tell you them in order, and you can answer them in any order you want to. My first question is, did you write this book as a political statement or because you felt it was an important part of military history? Are you acquainted in a personal way with the Kerry family? Was this written as a way of alerting people to this part of Kerry's history so that he would do well in the presidential debate? And how would you characterize the Eisenhower Institute? Would you say it's a quite independent institute? Eisenhower, of course, himself ran as a Republican president. So I'm just interested in your background, the Institute's background, and your relationship and your purpose in writing this book for John Kerry.
Okay, we did deal with some of that right at the beginning, but we can recap that real quick.
I'd like to say, I mean, look, I've written a lot of books. I've written biographies of everybody from Henry Ford to Dean Acheson, Rosa Parks, mm-hmm. James Forrestal, and I look for stories. I've been interested in the Vietnam War, and I wanted to tell a story of the veterans. The Vietnam vet is what was my real interest. I'm interviewing them for my center. And Kerry seemed to me to be a great story, I mean, which it's proving to be true. The media every week is writing about Kerry in Vietnam, taking stuff right out of my book. It was just a fascinating tale because it's about Operation Sea Lords and the Mekong Delta and riverine warfare. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, I always liked the movie Apocalypse Now, which was the only thing that's ever really dealt with the riverine warfare. There aren't any books about it, so it's a wide open territory. And then you get the great Vietnam veterans against the war, with Kerry at the center of that. And then the fact that John Kerry went on as a U.S. senator and sponsored the legislation for Agent Orange, went back 14 times looking for POWs and MIAs. You know, this thought that Vietnam still goes on with John Kerry, that his office has become the sort of central vortex of the veterans movement of Vietnam. Even today, if somebody has an Agent Orange problem, they go to Senator Kerry's office. All of that seemed like John Kerry was a great subject to, mm-hmm. to write about, and I was less concerned about whether how he comes off in the media. I always knew when my book came out that, you know, for example, I write about Kerry and Jane Fonda, and a lot of the flack Kerry's taken in the last weeks about Fonda comes directly from my book where I introduced it. I didn't write the book worrying about how it would play on John Kerry's campaign. I do think that the book helps John Kerry because it puts his biography in the focus, and he has a good story, and he's not the kind of guy who knows how to tell his own story. So in that way, the very fact that, you know, I'm writing about a guy who was at Yale and instead of copping out of service went to Vietnam and fought, that's a very gallant thing, and I think that comes across. And I think in this campaign, my book's been more helpful than hurtful to John Kerry. But it wasn't my intention to write it as a campaign book, although the timing of the release certainly gives one that impression. That's more of a publisher's decision to get it out. In fact, they rushed my book out in January because they thought Kerry was dead. I mean, he's going to bomb out. He was like number four at best in polls. Nobody thought he was going to get the Democratic nomination, so they just thought, boy, nobody's going to want to hear about John Kerry in June when they originally were scheduled to bring the book out. So they moved it up a little, which was a very wise move because Kerry suddenly emerged from, like Lazarus, from the dead to win in Iowa, and my book shot right up the bestseller list along with him.
So it was pushed by your publisher?
Yeah, just to get it out earlier because they thought Kerry was, they just wanted to capitalize a little bit that he was in the news in January. When I did my first interview January 7th on the Today Show, there was a feeling of instruction by producers not to talk about John Kerry because nobody cared a damn about him. That all people would have cared about would have been Vietnam. So we had marketed this book not about John Kerry, but as a Vietnam saga of the veterans and of that era. Now I've become the biographer of John Kerry, and my phone won't stop ringing with people with questions.
I bet. Could you characterize his early family and also the Eisenhower Institute, if that hasn't already
been covered? Well, we covered the Eisenhower Center fairly much. It's American Studies Center in New Orleans, where we do conferences and oral histories on everything from civil rights movement to the Second World War. And I have no great relationship with the Kerry family, per se, except, you know, I've interviewed Teresa Hines. For purposes of my book, I interviewed his first wife, John Julia Thorne, who was a major source. My first encounter with John Kerry was just a few years ago.
Okay. Very good. Well, I hope that gets to the caller's questions. Let's go on. And I do, just for anybody who wasn't listening in the beginning, maybe it is worth underscoring the point that we talked a little bit about. That is the fact that before you sat down to do your first interview with Kerry at the beginning of this project, you and he had never actually met.
Right. And I will say that, you know, we're doing this oral history project now at my center of all Vietnam. So if there are any Vietnam veterans listening, we're trying to interview as many Vietnam vets as we can. And both John and Teresa, but particularly Teresa, is very fascinated by my project in that we're taking the time to go to VA hospitals and interview people. And I've gotten to know her, and she has a great deal of concern about the people that are suffering from Agent Orange and the like in VA hospitals. She, in fact, is a hospital that she's funded in Pittsburgh, a VA hospital. So she's been the great champion of the oral history project that the Eisenhower Center is doing.
All right, let's go to another caller here, Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Had you located any of his crew before the book came out? Was that part of your
research? Yes, I interviewed all of them, and got photographs and their diaries or anything they kept from over there. Every single person who served with John Kerry, I got in touch with and interviewed.
Well, let me ask an old GI's question. What kind of officer was he? You said he was smart and tactically quick and had the best sort of reputation for getting guys home. Anything else?
Well, you know, the thing about Kerry is he was very athletic. I mean, he is 6'4", and he was back then. Paul was an extraordinary athlete, ice hockey, soccer, you know, every sport he played. He was an incredible skier. But mainly he spent a lot of time sailing as a kid, so he was very comfortable on water. He also spoke French fluently as a young man. And so when he went to Vietnam, a lot of the best navigational maps in the Delta were still French maps, and he had an easier time than some swift boat commanders with those maps. And he, you know, was somebody who, you know, was just first rate at what he was doing over there because he was very comfortable on water. He was a Navy man through and through, and you know, he was able to make snap decisions. He won his Bronze Star under fire for saving a drowning Green Beret. Won the Silver Star for, you know, beaching his boat and leaping on shore, which Navy men don't like going on shore in the jungles and chasing the gorilla through a garden path and shooting him dead. You know, he also, you hear a lot of these stories of monstrous acts committed by American military personnel in Vietnam, and you don't hear the humanitarian good deeds. One day, Kerry heard a noise. They saw some movement on the side of a bank, and Kerry ordered the boat beached, jumped out with his gun, and came across 42 elderly Vietnamese men and women, half-naked, lice and disease-ridden, starving to death. And he radioed that he just stumbled upon this sort of dirt hole with 42 Vietnamese kind of left to die. And he got back from his superior officer, leave them there and continue on mission. And Kerry broke orders, and he was in charge of a convoy of three swift boats and ordered all 42 brought on their boats, including, you know, with the possible contagious diseases, and ordered them on his boats, drove them back to base so they would get fed and medical attention. Kerry got chewed out for breaking orders, but he saved these 42 lives, and the men that were serving with Kerry today are very glad. They remember fondly the day that they weren't the bad guys in Vietnam, a day they really were there helping people. They helped these 42. And I think, like a good officer, whether you're in Iraq today or you were, you know, working in trying to, you know, deal with post-war Europe or Japan, Kerry showed a humanitarian touch to the native people, and that instilled the same feeling among his men. So one of the reasons they're all proud that they served with John Kerry today is they don't have atrocities to atone for. Were there accidental deaths? You betcha. I mean, I interviewed a man on one of Kerry's boats, the PCF-44, Jim Wasser, who heard a noise one afternoon in the jungle, and he shot, and then he saw it was just an old man and an ox he had killed. There's a story in my book about a sampan at night in a curfew zone coming right at them, and they ordered it to stop, and it wouldn't, so Kerry and his men fired on the boat, only to find out it was a bunch of rice and a woman and children, and there's this dead girl laying there on top of the rice, and they had done it by accident. So I don't want to pretend there are not grim moments there, but Kerry, by and large, is constantly trying to think of, we are here to help these people, let's try to help them every day how we can. So the men that served with him are now proud veterans of the Vietnam War. They're not ashamed of their service. They're proud of it. And they attribute that largely to John Kerry's leadership.
High testimony. Let me ask one final question then. Was there a defining moment when he turned against the war? How did that happen? I'll hang up.
Kerry so loved the Navy uniform that he refused to protest the war while in uniform. So the media has missed this, too. Now, when Kerry returns, it's March of 1969, and he has three Purple Hearts, gets sent home. He stays in uniform for the rest of 69 into 1970, And he's working, he's assigned now to Admiral Walter Schleck, and he serves as a naval aide and goes with the admiral, who was a great Korean War hero, this admiral, goes with him to places like Greenland and Panama, other locales. But by Christmas of 69, Carey, still in uniform, decides he's going to go to Admiral Schleck, and he's not going to protest the war while in uniform because he would never do that to the Navy uniform. He goes to Schleck and says, look, I will finish out. I got 8 more months, and I will continue my duty for you, sir, but I would like to get out and run for Congress as an anti-war candidate because I really think the war in Vietnam has to end in my conscience. And Schleck said, I understand. I will let you out to go run for Congress. That was unusual, and it was a turning point in Carey's life. And I had asked, why would Admiral Schleck allow this to happen? And the answer was he had gotten frustrated with Nixon, Kissinger policies in Cambodia, Laos, the lying about Vietnam, the secret bombings, all the things we know now. Schleck was more of a liberal admiral, and he sympathized with Carey, who he'd become fond of, and thought, yeah. And what's significant is Carey went to run for office. John Kerry's always protesting the war in Vietnam within the system. He wants to run for office. He goes to the State Department and briefs them on what happened in the Mekong Delta, officially writing a paper for the State Department or U.S. government to better understand. He testifies in front of Fulbright. You know, he's protesting the war largely from within the system. He does go on marches, and he gets arrested once for an evening on a march from Concord, Massachusetts to Boston, May Day of 71, March for, and, you know, so I'm not trying to say he's not on the streets, but he's somebody who really, you know, believes in the U.S. government, believes in the system, and feels that it's not the America that's wrong, it's the Nixon administration's continuing policy. They said we get out, and instead they've increased troops. And from a historic perspective, Carey's protest, by and large, was one of I think, an act of conscience. I will be very critical of one aspect of Carey anti-war. In his testimony to Fulbright, there are a lot of eloquent moments, but there's one where he, I think, overdraws the atrocities that occurred in Vietnam by American troops there. Everything he says is true, but it's like condensing them all into one sentence and making it sound like it was more of a problem than it was. I don't mean to minimize the My Lies that occurred in Vietnam. They're horrible. They did occur, and they have to be fixed that American troops never do those again when sent abroad. But Carey made, I think, more out of that and the testimony. With that one sharp criticism aside, though, you see John Carey trying constantly to have nonviolent protest, to write thoughtful essays, to give thoughtful speeches, to explain things on television to the American people in a very rational and historically accurate way. So I find that his anti-war protest from, you know, 35 years later, when one really looks at it, was a high water mark in his public career. It's an act of real conscience in the way he did it, waiting till he got out of uniform, trying to work within the system, I think is the right way to do it.
About 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We have some other callers. I just want to introduce again our guest, Douglas Brinkley. He is director of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies and also professor of history at University of New Orleans. And he's the author of the book Tour of Duty, John Carey and the Vietnam War. It's published by William Morrow and Company. Next up, we have a caller, also Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Periodically, I see lists of things that college students don't comprehend because they weren't born yet. And I was thinking, after hearing a remark that Colin Powell years ago had made a statement about people who hid out in champagne as in the drink, guard units where they were safe, and which is what Bush did. And thinking, you know, I wonder what people who are college age now and who or might be of age to be in a National Guard unit, what they comprehend about that. And I was thinking, in the Iraq War, it's the National Guard units that are in danger and are going unexpectedly to for the people who are in the units to Iraq and their lives are on the line. I'm of the generation where I was thinking about getting married in 1968. Well, I got married in 1968. And our whole lives, excuse me, I've got a tickle in my throat. In addition to trying to figure out what was going on with this crazy war, your plans were just totally up in the air. The rules for the draft, you didn't have necessarily a choice about whether you went or not. You could enlist, but there was also the draft, and the rules kept changing every year and became more and more. They pulled in more and more people, but even so, the people who had privilege and who were in college, for instance, could at certain times stay out of the war because they were in college. But the people who were poorer, who didn't have the education, et cetera, were the ones who tended to be pulled into the war, who sacrificed more of their lives. And I really wonder whether Bush's support would be even as where it is now if there were a draft today, and if people who are younger had a real sense of what it was like to not know what was going to happen to yourself and whether you were going to be called up and whether you were going to go to a war you didn't necessarily agree with.
Well, I think it's a very good and important point you're making. Look, first off, everybody played Vietnam differently. You know, one of the reasons it continues to be kind of covered in the media and have great drama to it is it's one of those moments you define your biography. What did you do when your number came up in the Vietnam era? How did you play your Vietnam card? I personally feel that people did all sorts of things, and that's just the way it was. And whether you went to Canada or whether you went to get finagle a deferment, or whether you tried to get into the National Guard, said not to go to Vietnam. I mean, it was a difficult, contentious time, and people did different things. I've never particularly thought badly or ill of President Bush's decision to try to not go to Vietnam, to go into the Guard. It was unfair that he leapt over 100,000 other names due to family connections. That part's annoying. So I think he has a right, President Bush, to be proud of serving in the Air Guard, and he made that decision. What I as a historian, have to object to is President Bush's distorting just what our caller is talking about. I mean, when he wore a jumpsuit and went on the USS Lincoln and claimed mission accomplished, pretending, make-believe soldier, and then says that his critics shouldn't criticize the way he finagled out of going to Vietnam, I find it disingenuous. And I don't think President Bush has been honest to the American people. The truth of the matter was, leaping ahead of names, not knowing where one was for months when you were in Alabama. I think Terry McAuliffe used a too strong a word, that President Bush was AWOL. I mean, that was too dramatic. But it's a very incomplete record. And the truth of the matter is President Bush went into the Air Guard because he didn't want to go over and get shot off, his butt shot to bits in Vietnam. He just refuses to admit that. Instead, he keeps trying to pretend he was some great National Guard hero, and that, he was, did his duty. And he won't speak straight about what it was really all about back then. And people like our caller know that, and I think it leads to a credibility gap, as they're saying, that people know when Bush talks on the National Guard, it's BS. And this is a president who, no matter how one feels about him, has connected with a lot of people on being authentic, a straight shooter. I call it like I see it. I talk straight. And he's so clearly not talking straight about his time in the National Guard that it really starts making one wonder. And I think that's what's happened these last few months. Bush, I feel, could have gotten out of this whole National Guard debate simply by saying, you know what, I was a roguish kid back then. If I had to do it over again, I wish I would have done my duty. And I just want to thank all those people who went to Vietnam and fought. Tell them thank you for fighting for me and for our country. And I'll try to make it up now as commander-in-chief and do my duty as president. But back then, I was my head wasn't in the right place, and I was didn't want to go over there. But for you guys that went, we want to tell you Vietnam vets for the first time, thank you for what you did over there. If he would have said that, this thing would have been a dead issue. Instead, he's continually trying to pretend that it's essentially the equivalent of what he did was the same as going to Vietnam, and it was not. I think it's a disingenuous, the disingenuousness of his statements that are making this a lingering issue.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. I want to get back here for a second to Mr. Kerry. When he was at Yale, was he politically active? And prior to his enlisting in the Navy in 1966, is there some kind of a record of his making any comments at all about the Vietnam War?
Yes, he was opposed to it. Remember, the Vietnam War has different phases. So this is a Kerry in early 66. And he's against it. In fact, his class oration was originally written and printed in the yearbook as a kind of typical boilerplate kind of commencement address. He changed it last minute and turned it into a questioning of the limits of American intervention and whether it wasn't wiser to stick with our NATO allies and not prioritize Vietnam. That's in 66. Kerry, as an intellectual, as a young thinker loving this country greatly, always saw that Vietnam was just a mistake. Not that the Cold War was a mistake, but that it was the wrong, Vietnam was the wrong war, wrong place, wrong time. And his views really changed very little on that. But look, it's a conflicted generation, and Kerry's conflicted. On one hand, he wants to serve his country in uniform. On the other hand, the hot spot, where he's very likely to get assigned, is an area he doesn't think we should be in. And it's a testimony that even though Kerry was against the war, he went to Vietnam to serve. President Bush says he was for the war in Vietnam, yet he wanted to finagle out from going. And that's where, when one writes biography of these two figures, that period is Kerry wins that era. And I think the greatest thing the Republican Party could do today is not raise Vietnam, ignore it, and move on to John Kerry's Senate record, where there's a lot of things to rip at him. I think every time they go after Kerry on Vietnam, it only plays into John Kerry because he has a spectacular biography from that era, both as a decorated soldier and as somebody who later protested the war.
Let's go on to some other callers here. We have about 3-4 minutes left to do at least one. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, quickly, I didn't know that Kerry had been in Panama. Do you happen to know if he saw any kind of negative aspects to our presence in South America, any injustice that he saw? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, that's an interesting question. I tell you, unfortunately, I can't answer it. I just know he went there as an admiral's aide. I don't think he saw much. I interviewed him, and he told me a little bit, seeing the Panama Canal for the first time and what it was like as a young man there, but I have no idea. I do know that during his Senate career, Kerry was one of the chief whistleblowers on the Iran-Contra affair, and in fact, I'm toying with writing an article about Oliver North versus John Kerry because it was Kerry, more than anybody, who was aiming fire at North trying to expose him during that period and made a lot of enemies on the right, Kerry, for his attempts to go after Oliver North and company during the Iran-Contra scandal.
Okay, we'll try to go real quick here. Line two, Urbana. Hello.
Okay, during the time frame of Senator Kerry's life that you're writing about, other issues were around also. They were the civil rights movement, equal rights for women movement, and the emerging pollution control movement. Did Mr. Kerry make any comments of record on any of those issues?
Mainly on civil rights. When he connected with an African-American bishop in New England, and Kerry, while at Yale, joined the voter registration drive from Mississippi while a student there. His great hero was Martin Luther King Jr. I have in his diaries, his excitement of finding the autobiography of Malcolm X and things. But most of Carey's time, you know, right out of college, while, you know, in other words, 68, for example, I mean, or 67 and 68, he's in the U.S. Navy the whole time. And so his comments from that period, getting directly from his diary. As for women's movement and environmental movement in the 60s, I have no record of that in the diary. So Vietnam focused. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. I guess I keep coming back to the question, the fact that now, you know, almost 40 years since Carey went into the Navy, and so long after Vietnam, that his service there and the war has emerged as some kind of issue, if not the leading issue, some kind of an issue in the race for president here now in 2004. And it just says something about what sort of a scar that's left on our consciousness in this country.
Absolutely. And it is the reason why I wrote the book. I mean, I've always been very befuddled by the first President Bush's comment after our war in the Middle East, kicking Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, and I might add rightfully so. President Bush said, well, now that we won that Gulf War, the Vietnam syndrome is over. And I think in Bush's, and I don't believe the Vietnam syndrome is over. I think it's very much alive. But you have to see, it's a generational debate that's still going on. The veterans that I've interviewed, most of them conservatives, or prefer the Republican Party to the Democrat from Vietnam. Many of them are thinking of going with Kerry right now over this issue of veterans benefits. I mean, Kerry has championed increased funding to VA hospitals, better medical attention, better access to prescription drugs, while President Bush has been slashing it. And for a lot of Vietnam vets of that era, they're in their 60s now, and you know they're heading fast into retirement age, and they would like their VA benefits that they're counting on to be good. Kerry seems to not have forgotten about them, where President Bush, I think, is always more concerned with the active people in the armed forces.
Pardon me for interrupting you there, but we're just going to have to stop because we've used the time. I just want to say thanks very much for giving us your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a good show.
Our guest, Douglas Brinkley, and if you'd like to read the book, it's titled Tour of Duty, John Kerry and the Vietnam War, and it's published by William Morrow and Company.